This morning, in the first part of the show, the second part of the show, we'll be talking about a couple of things. The thing I'll do first is introduce our guest. We're talking with Toby Miller. He's professor of cinema and cultural studies at New York University. And you might recall that he was here, I guess, a year ago, more or less, when he was spending some time at Unit 1. And we talked about one of the things that he is interested in and written about. We talked about the spy espionage genre in television and film. And one thing we talked quite a bit about was the very popular classic TV show The Avengers, which was the subject of a book that he wrote, was published in 1997. He's also written a number of other things. He's written about sports in popular culture, about film theory. He's got a lot of experience as a social commentator. He spent time living in Australia and also here in the United States. He's here to speak in a series that's starting now and will be a year-long series of talks. This is under the auspices of the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus, talking about the changing role of the university. So we'll talk a little bit about that to start, but I also know that he has written a book about the Olympics, which is yet to come out, and since it may still be somewhat fresh in people's minds from having seen the most recent Olympics in Australia, we can talk a little bit about that too. So we'll do two of these topics, and welcome questions on either. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Nice to be back.
This series, and I expect that we'll probably be talking with a lot of the people who are here to be part of this series, and there'll be people from different sorts of disciplines coming at this question from different ways. But the overall subject is the university, what it has been, what it is, what it's going to be. And I think a particular focus is the idea that more and more universities are forming partnerships with private business to do research. And in fact, here where our building is located, one day I think we're going to be right in the middle of a high-tech research park because it looks like they're going to build all around us. Mm-hmm. And it's happening other places on this campus, and it's happening in a lot of other places. And I think that folks have taken it as an opportunity to ask some questions about, well, what's the university really for as a research institution and as an educational institution? So as someone who is a kind of a cultural critic person, how do you come at that whole question of, what is the university for?
That's a really good question, I think. It is a fundamental, foundational one for all of us. Most people who are cultural critics think of the university as a place to engage in critique, to produce new ideas, new research, and new minds, and spread those ideas and those minds in ways that will enable people to be better citizens, more competent citizens, folks who are in a position to change the world in which they live by, you know, active participation in political life, cultural life, civic life. But of course, that's all very well for cultural critics. They, thank heavens perhaps, don't comprise the vast majority of people in universities. Many people in universities are there not because of a notion of an overall cultural contribution of the university, but because, quite reasonably, they have specific agendas in very special areas, whether it's aerospace or classics or agriculture. And in many instances, take for instance agriculture at the University of Illinois or any one of a number of other major universities in the United States, that's always been a heavily applied area. It's always been an area where there has been a connection between industrial interests, governmental interests, and research interests. What I think we're seeing that's different is that almost every area of university life now is supposed to make those connections to the private sector and to government interests, regardless of its history. And furthermore, much of the research that once we all did because it was felt it was there to go in the public domain for everybody's good outside market relations, nowadays that research is meant to be as much as possible available to private industry and often is done on contract specifically for private industry. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, universities are becoming part of the research and development sector for finance.
Mm. Well, it seems that for a long time, at least at big research universities like this one, there has been an argument over or some tension around the question, are we supposed to be here to do pure research, to break new ground, to ask interesting questions simply because they're interesting and the answers might be interesting? Or is the university something of a trade school at a high level, but something that's designed to prepare people for careers, to go out and make a living? And maybe that we're still going to continue to argue about that. But is that still what we're talking about, or is it somehow now become something different?
No, that's a really good way of putting it. I actually think there are still strong connections of that kind. On the one hand, it's there to provide a kind of disinterested education. Doesn't mean students don't care. It means that it's not about necessarily how I can get ahead or I can make this money or become this kind of professional, but about producing the well-rounded individual, you know, the person who understands civic life, public life, commercial life, and so on, the good citizen that I was referring to earlier. But there's always been intention with that other equally exciting and important side, which is about equipping a person, in a sense, with a trade, as you say. Mm. Now, one of the good sides to the trade path is that stops universities from being too elitist, too snobby, too removed from the ordinary concerns of daily people's lives. I don't think anybody's concerned about that influence. I think that's really good. I think what worries folks is that increasingly the rewards and the finances and so on that are made available within universities operate as though the universities themselves were in internal competition. Let me give you an example, not from the University of Illinois, but from NYU, where I teach. NYU is a private school. Its motto is a private university in the public service. It's not for-profit, of course, but on the other hand, it's entirely tuition-driven and it doesn't get state funds. Having said that, the law school is, as in the case of many universities, extremely wealthy. It has large donors, it has big, very, very expensive land at its disposal and can pay huge salaries to professors. Conversely, the classics department, which I'm not in, so this is not, you know, me complaining, is not in a position to run the conferences, set up the physical locations, and attract the professors with good salaries that the law school is. Now, in another kind of world, a world that was about universities as internally collaborative institutions, you could see a case where you and I would sit down, you're in charge of the law school, David, I'm in charge of classics, and I say, I'll buy you a beer because I'm a nice guy. Wouldn't it be good if you would give us some of the loot that you take in order that classics, which after all is very important to the study of law historically, can actually have a few more resources? Now, that kind of exchange, cross-subsidization it's sometimes called, increasingly doesn't happen, because part of the change in universities is the notion that each unit within them is in competition with the others. That, I think, is really sad, because ideally we'd like to see the person running the trade part of the university sitting down with the person running the criticism part of university and finding that they probably have more in common than they realized. But if they're competing for resources, how does that conversation happen? Mm.
So it sounds as if what's happened is this notion of competition that some people talk so fondly of in the economic sphere has now made its way into the university. And there must be some people who would make that same argument that says, well, competition between the Department of Classics and Law is good. Competing for resources, competing for students, because that forces the Department of, you know, maybe you say you don't have to worry about the law school, but that forces those folks over there at Classics to come into the modern age or do mm-hmm. whatever. That may or may not be true, but it seems as if that kind of thinking gets into all areas of culture now.
Absolutely. Now, of course, this is the United States. Some of it's built on competition. I wouldn't want to deny that. You can tell from my voice I've lived my whole life here and I'm proud to have done so. No, but the fact is collaboration is equally part of the United States. A pluribus unum is not just how do we make migrants love being here and is multiculturalism okay. A pluribus unum, you know, out of the many come one, is also about collaboration and working together. It's not just competition. And I think something's been lost in that change, as you say, in many parts of our culture, towards the idea that a market-driven ethos is the best way to achieve everything. The other major change that I'd reference is this. In terms of what universities could rely on for funding, something very spectacular happened 10 years ago. We all know what it was, the end of the Cold War. It's astonishing how much research in university sectors was undertaken, both directly and indirectly, essentially with Cold War money. The federal government really made not only science, but lots and lots of different areas, linguistics, communications, you name it, very well-heeled institutions indeed right across the United States because of research that needed to be done into things like the military, new technology, behavioral change, and so on, how to deal with countries in the third world that were decolonizing, would they become Marxist-Leninists and so on. This was a huge source of funds that universities got, research schools, from the 1950s through to the beginning of the last decade, that basically was turned off, the spigot was turned off, because there was no longer that need. And that money was not always, they didn't just go into rocket science, it went into people like me. It was very disinterested money. It was money that wasn't directed towards immediate applications. When that ended, suddenly this great wash of dough that had come our way was no longer available. And that's another force. It's not just the fashion towards market-based competition that's changed things. It's the end of the Cold War. Even people who were on the liberal left, such as myself, did very well, very nicely, thank you, out of the Cold War. And that's the incredible irony.
Well, the sort of scenario that you suggested, I am certain that at many universities the same thing is true. The wealthy law school and the folks at the classics who are maybe sort of scraping by, and certainly on this campus and a lot of others, one area where we have seen great growth is in various kinds of high-tech fields, biotechnology and electrical, computer engineering, things like that. If you look at what's happening with the traditional areas of the humanities, classics, the English department, maybe the history department, foreign languages, and those sorts of things, is it true, do you think, that there are things that we used to do there that we're not doing anymore? Have those more traditional kinds of parts of what we consider to be the liberal education languished as science and engineering particularly have grown?
Well, they certainly suffer when it comes to claims on the public purse, and more particularly the private purse, because, of course, those traditional humanities areas are not the ones that look sexy in terms of being able to do applied research that's of immediate application either in the governmental area or the commercial one. At the same time, there are some other pressures that have changed the face of the humanities, pressures that I think I would welcome a little more. Let me give you an example. We frequently hear stories today in, say, a French department or a Spanish department or an English department focusing on the languages, where a couple of people retire, perhaps. One of them might do medieval. One of them might do Old Norse, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Specialist areas, ones we should know about, ones where the United States has been a world leader in archiving and discovering and theorizing, you know, important aspects of our shared history as people. Nowadays, there's political pressure for multicultural reasons to try to make those areas open up more to important everyday language and cultural politics of the United States in the contemporary era. So what you might get is a situation where someone's retired who did Old Norse, someone's retired who did medieval. What do you do with those two jobs? Well, the university says save some money and be more relevant, and also assuage the cries from the students of more relevance to their community. So you create one job out of two. The one job perhaps goes to somebody who is Hispanic, who's teaching Latino-Latina studies. That suits the university's purposes. It quells political dissent, and it also does away with two jobs. You only pay one. It loads the incoming minority professor with immense pressure in terms of whom she or he has to represent, in terms of the sense that they've been brought in for one job when once there were two, resentment sometimes on the part of other old traditions in the department. How come Old Norse is gone and here's another Hispanic or here's a Hispanic, whatever it is. So, as I said, I partially welcome it because I think it's very important to make that multicultural push, but it makes very special pressures on humanities people of that kind.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Toby Miller. He's professor of cinema studies at New York University, and he's here in Champaign-Urbana to be the first speaker in this series of talks. They're all being organized by the folks at the Center for Advanced Study, looking at the changing role of the university. He will be speaking on the U of I campus 4 o'clock this afternoon at the Levis Faculty Center, and I'm sure anyone who's interested in attending should feel welcome, and I also feel fairly sure that probably other speakers in this series will have here on the show as well, so people outside of Champaign-Urbana can hear what they have to say. Questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is that you try to be brief just so we can include as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Freeport, line 4. Hello.
I'd like to ask him, where was he educated? In England somewhere? I consider Oxford and Cambridge to be very, very class institutions. Where did you receive your education?
Oh, thank you for the question, sir. Nice to hear from you. Well, I was born in Britain, but my parents migrated to Australia when I was a child. However, they couldn't really make up their minds, I guess, and so they went backwards and forwards between Britain and Australia. And I had my high school education in both places, but when it came to college, I actually studied in Australia. And my father briefly taught at Oxford, but not I wasn't associated with it. So, yes, I guess it is a class institution, and he worked there for a while, but I didn't study there. I went to public universities in Australia, one of which was what we would think of as a Research One school in American terms, as a very elite place, and the other one was not an elite school at all. It was somewhere that was basically for working people and their families, so I had a bit of each, and then I came here.
Well, I like to tell you that I feel I'm a victim of the Cold War, you know, Cold War politics. I was at the University of Wisconsin as a graduate student. In the late 50s, the Cuban Revolution came along, and the University Socialist Club, which was very frowned upon by the administration, by the way, the Socialist Club went to the extent of organizing a trip to Cuba. Do you follow me? I went down there to Cuba for just 10 days. It was a student study trip. There was no drugs, sex, and beer like they have in Florida, organized to Florida these days. You know, all the colleges and universities in the U.S. have those things. Well, I was down there just 10 days. I come back to the University of Wisconsin. On the campus, about 10 days later after I return, I get a registered letter from the Dean of Students. And they say I'm not permitted to re-enroll for the doctoral program. I was just going to enter my doctoral program in history. You follow me?
Yes.
So this shows the kind of Cold War it was waged against students who wanted to experience the new socialist Cuba. And I feel that universities in this country, universities especially, and colleges, private colleges too, have been instruments of the Cold War, waged, and they've been used against students and especially people from working class and farming students. You follow me?
Yes.
Yes, sir. And there has to be a drastic reform. Before the revolution in Cuba, 1% of the students attended colleges and universities. Now it's at least 30% that go on from the secondary level are in colleges and universities today in Cuba. So that shows the advances they've made there.
Yeah. No, I very much appreciate your call. I think that my comment about the Cold War needs to be contextualized, and I think what you said is extremely important. What I was trying to get across was that the irony of the Cold War was that the federal government put so much money into universities to do research that it didn't only go to those people who were doing applied or anti-Soviet research. It went to a lot of other people. But that's not to counter the red baiting that went on and the way in which opportunities for education and research were cut back on political bases. And I very much appreciate the caller's account of his own experience of discrimination at the University of Wisconsin. Those stories are legion. They are extremely disturbing, of course. One of the things that we cherish about universities in the United States is freedom of speech, freedom of expression, the opportunity to hold ideas that are contrary to those of the administration. It's one of the great privileges that I have as a tenured member of faculty in an industry, the almost the only industry where there is tenure in this country, as it were, that I am permitted to speak my mind. People don't have to listen if they don't want to, but I have that right. And when we hear stories such as the callers of that being abrogated, it's obviously a very, very serious matter. So I appreciate the story and a slight corrective to my rather glib account of Cold War.
Well, just since you now I'm interested, since you touch on the idea of tenure, because some people in the university and in many universities are concerned that the kind of thinking that you see in for-profit corporations is making its way into the university. People are starting to talk about things like competition and cost effectiveness and things like that. And there are people who, some of them in the governing boards of universities, who would like to see tenure done away with. And it seem, and I believe that actually it is the case that over time, the number of tenured faculty has declined. And in many places, as older faculty members have retired, when the new people come in, the idea of some people's idea is that, well, we ought to make those should no longer be tenure track positions anymore, which as far as they're concerned, you know, what it means is it makes it much easier to fire people and raises this issue of what about intellectual freedom. Is where do things stand now with concerns of university people on the issue of tenure and whether in the future there will still be tenure?
It's a very good point. You've raised a whole series of issues there, David, that are crucial. First of all, we all know the guy at the end of the corridor where we work who doesn't pull his or her weight. I mean, I'm sure there's no one at WILL like that. Everywhere I've worked, there is. And you just think, God, why can't we get rid of this person? But that's something you say into your breakfast cereal. Most of us believe, I think, that working people have much to contribute if the conditions are right, if the context is right, that people are prepared to retrain, to relearn, to make themselves anew in the interest of continued employment and continued relevance, and that they want to give something to their society. So I would say, first of all, I'm committed to income security, to job security for people in all kinds of sectors. And so rather than seeing tenure as something that only exists in universities and is under threat and perhaps should be done away with, I'd like to see it as something expanding elsewhere. So that's my first point. The second point about intellectual freedom is this. Although we have a free media in the United States, in the sense that it is not completely shackled by the government and because of the First Amendment has constitutional protections against such incursions to its autonomy, we have, as we all know, with the exception of NPR and its affiliates and university radio stations and so on, an increasingly concentrated pattern of media ownership. We have an increasingly concentrated pattern of media genre, such that programs like yours are now only on certain kinds of radio stations or television networks. Everybody knows we have niche markets that take away the opportunity for there to be a space in which discussion is held at a very general level for some time, allowing a to and fro and debate and so on, instead of everything being punctuated by commercials and shifts to other kinds of music. Where else can that happen nowadays if not the university? And that's the one place where it can happen. And if you have people living in fear that their job will be done away with, because of allegedly because of money issues, but perhaps because of issues to do with what they're teaching or how they're teaching it, and if we're certain that the protocols for hiring them and retaining them are fair-minded and open and professional, then let's retain that space. Isn't that absolutely crucial? Isn't it? Isn't it really, really important? And I think that the sense that there is this space of potential social criticism or scientific innovation that comes from basic research and not just applied research is very much bundled up with tenure and its importance. So I'm a strong defender of tenure. Now, I have people, I actually teach in a part of NYU, but it's a conservatory. It's like an art school. So a lot of the people there are set designers, choreographers, ballet dancers, film production technicians, and so on, for whom universities are somewhat odd creatures, for whom the idea of tenure seems ludicrous. They see themselves happily as independent contractors who don't want lifelong employment and who don't like the idea of tenure, quite hostile to it in certain ways. They believe that their creative energies and juices flow from being on the edge. Well, I respect their position, but I also think that's something that flows from the kind of chronic income insecurity that people in those occupations are subjected to, and what goes along with it, which is the belief that without this, how would they be creative? I think, in a way, they're missing out on something. So I'm a strong believer in tenure. I think that some version of it will survive. And let me finish this answer by saying there's one particular reason for that. When it comes to the star system at the top of universities, where people are very well paid, they're well heeled, they have nice lives, not well heeled by comparison with the private sector, but well heeled by comparison with folks who are teaching in two-year colleges, community colleges, and so on, those elite figures will only stay in the university sector instead of going to work in corporations if there are some benefits that they know apply because of their belief in the pure nature of inquiry, because of their commitment to teaching, because they know that they will have a job virtually no matter what. Those are the things that will attract the stars and retain them. But we have to remember that underneath the tenure system, lying underneath it, is a system of casualization and proletarianization, where, as you said in your remark, David, what were full-time jobs are being made into part-time jobs. There's no question of tenure. There's no question of research. Highly qualified, brilliant young people and not so young people, such as ourselves, mm-hmm. are called in to do teaching with no chance of career advancement. And so all those of us with tenure, with that freedom, who are at the top or near it must constantly bear in mind those who are supporting us, who are holding us up.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Toby Miller. He is professor of cinema studies in the Tisch School of the Arts at New York University. And if you're interested in hearing more from him on this very subject, he will be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. This is the first in what will be a year-long series of lectures sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study, looking at the university's changing role. And he'll be talking on culture, citizenship, and commodities. That's today. He is interested in a number of things. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we talked when he was here at Unit 1 about espionage films and television series. He's also written about sport and popular culture. And for the sort of the second part of the conversation here, I thought we'd have a radical change of direction and talk about something a little bit different, and that is about the Olympics, which a lot of folks watched just not very long ago. And it's something that you're – generally, I know sport is something that you're interested in, and this in particular is the subject that you've written on. What are your reflections on having seen this most recent Olympics?
Well, I think the thing that struck most of us was kind of NBC hatred. instead of freeway rage, we had NBC rage, many of us. I think there were some interesting things about the coverage that were especially important. People will remember even back in the Atlanta Olympics, Summer Olympics of 1996, it seemed so strange that the women's gymnastics culminated at midnight on Saturday night, just when NBC was about to go out of its primetime Saturday night coverage. And, of course, it wasn't that the thing was going out live at all. It was on tape delay. And as everybody is aware, NBC follows what it calls the plausibly live coverage model. I think this alienated a lot of people. We all knew we were getting a raw deal. The other side that I think was very noticeable this time, though again it's been in evidence for some years, was that NBC, and this I applaud in some sense, is trying to reach out from the conventional sports audience to different people. So what that means is less boxing, less weightlifting, and less obsession with numbers. I mean, one of the things about particularly masculinist relationships to sports, as you know, is data. So yards gained, yards lost, ERA, you know, all these questions. And being able to know the numbers, know the exact record times that have been set and so on is quite a fetish for a lot of men. Alienating for a lot of women, not to say there aren't men who hate stats, not to say there aren't women who love them, but that is one of the traditional distinctions that's drawn and that alienates the female viewer. NBC, like many other television networks, is much more interested in the female viewer than it used to be. And in fact, women viewers are now a much more significant part of the audience for TV sports than ever before. So the corollary of this was, as people will recall, instead of finding out David Inge ran the 100 metres dash in 9 seconds, we discovered that Toby Miller's mother broke her left hip 17 years ago when pushing a shopping trolley, and that's been something he struggled with through his battles of alcohol and drugs ever since. The fact that Toby Miller came 21st in the race it doesn't matter. There's a human interest story that means that we forget about David Inge's spectacular world record-breaking achievement, particularly if David Inge commits the unforgivable human felony of not being an American citizen, whereas Toby Miller is. Mm. And that humanization, I think, was a very striking aspect of the coverage.
I think certainly the criticism that has been made over and over again of the way that American television networks cover the Olympics is that we spend most of our time talking about, obsessing about uncovering American athletes. You know, I had the experience, though, of this time around of being in Canada when the Olympics was going on. And there, I'd spent quite a lot of time listening to the CBC radio. Now, there on television, the people in Canada, they were also watching NBC. I know that that they're doing that. But I thought that it was interesting listening to CBC radio and in fact, they did the same thing. They talk, if someone won, if it was an Australian or American or something like that, they certainly acknowledged that fact. But an awful lot of their coverage that I heard on CBC radio was about Canadian athletes, which started me thinking about that criticism of American broadcasters and wondering, now, if we could go around the world and sample other broadcasters, would we really find the same thing that everybody in to the extent that they have broadcasting in Italy, in France, in China, in Nigeria, they're really what people want to know and what they're talking about is what their athletes are doing.
Now, I think there's much fairness in what you say, but a couple of points in response to that. Mm-hmm. One would be there have been some comparative studies done, not so much of overall coverage, but of coverage of the opening and closing ceremonies of the games, these very spectacular mm-hmm. moments when you see all the flags and the marchers, the representatives of the different nations and so on. Whilst coverage of Sydney 2000 was a little different, NBC was more open and Catholic and comprehensive in its coverage, previous games have seen real distinctions between the way United States networks cover and other countries do, in the sense that other countries, by and large, do show every nation marching in and have respectful things to say about the achievements of that nation. United States coverage, by and large, until 2000, did not show many of the nations coming in, if they weren't significant in terms of being feeder nations to United States in immigrant terms or were not major competitors. And many, many disrespectful things are said about other countries. Now, to a certain extent, that applies elsewhere. So that's one counter to what you say. The mm-hmm. other thing is this. There are two feeds of the television Olympics that are sent around the world. In other words, there are two completely different sets of, you know, camera setups and so on for major events. One is the one that is sent out by the host broadcaster. In the case of, for example, Canada, it would be the CBC probably that would be the host broadcaster that provides the video link for other nations. And the second one is the US one, because the US must have its own cameras, do its own coverage. Mm-hmm. Everybody does their own audio coverage, but other countries take the one feed from the host broadcaster, except the United States, which, because NBC pays many, many more millions of dollars than any other broadcaster, gets a special deal. So we do get a privileged angle on things. Other countries, although they edit it, of course, for their own national purposes, get a collective feed. So we actually do have a visually quite distinct experience from that other nations get in terms of Olympic coverage.
Well, that's interesting. It seemed that in Canada the big story was there was a Canadian equestrian who got into trouble for drug use. And for days and days and days, that was the big story, whether or not this guy would be allowed to ride and how eventually that he wasn't. And we heard all sorts of details about this, including the fact that his horses were there, but he was still home in Canada. and actually, there's a reason you have to get the horses there to get them acclimated, but it struck me just in how much time they spend talking about Canadian athletes. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't be surprised. That's what the home folks are going to be interested in.
Well, one of the things about the Olympics is that, of course, ideally, they're meant to be about young people coming together to bridge the gap between nations, the idealism of youth, the utopia of sport, and so on. But, ironically, you can't compete unless you're actually endorsed by a nation. You must represent a nation. So in one sense, it does have that national chauvinism built into the system. And we've seen that very powerfully, certainly during the Cold War, when there was the medal table created once the Soviet Union joined in the 50s and East Germany in the 70s, and then much later on China in the 90s. The sense of competition between different power blocks was very, very intense. Now, a lot of people look back on previous Olympic times and feel as though it was a different kind of games, that it wasn't as cheapened by commodity goods, by marketization, by advertising and commerce. Mm-hmm. When the athletes weren't paid, it was a truly amateur event. And nowadays, they're no different, in a sense, from pro football players, basketball players, baseball players, hockey players, and so on. That there was a more idealistic side to the games that came through, this universal global project of youth and peacefulness and so on, that's been lost. And I think that's one of the issues that gets raised again and again for people as we see how the Olympics are changed by television, by private funding sources and so on. It's one of those things where I'm ambivalent. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I think athletes deserve to get paid for their labor. They used to get paid under the table. At least now it's all out in the open. On the other hand, I think about the terrible privations and dangers that athletes are put through in terms of drug use, not just illegal drug use, but also training regimes that are brutal for their bodies, that leave them broken and bowed later in life. And I think about, again, getting back to our conversation in the first half of the hour, questions of competition and just how beneficial competition is. These are young bodies, impressionable people, who are being taught that they're the best in the world, but only while they defeat and best others, and who at 18 or 19, unless they're equestrian riders, are left basically with no education, broken bodies in many instances, and no sense of what they might be. And that should be our utopia of global youth coming together seems rather sad to me.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign, line number one.
Hi, I agree with much of what you both have been saying. It's interesting that you mentioned Canada because that's where I grew up, and until 1990, that's where I watched all of my Olympics. And I would say that this is the worst Olympic coverage I have ever seen, bar none. I mean, not only did NBC boil all the action and passion right out of the games by not showing it live, but every time you turned around, you got another little vignette about an athlete who, I mean, unless it was a huge story about something, it's not very interesting. I mean, the games speak for themselves. There's so many events that we could have been watching and so many other performers from other nations, when instead I was watching, and I've forgotten her name, trying bullseye CDs in her backyard with her bow and arrow. I mean, that's absurd. It happens every 4 years, and the U.S. just cannot seem to get it right with the coverage. And I'm just depressed that NBC has the rights locked up for I don't know how many more Olympics. Because I just think, you know, the games speak for themselves. And as far as the drug testing in Canada and the equestrian, we had the same thing with C.J. Hunter, the husband of Marion Jones, who wasn't even competing at the games.
Mm-hmm. And that became a big story.
But it was a non-story.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they need to do something because, I mean, I hope the ratings, when it finally, I don't know if they've come out finally when it's all been said and done, but I hope they were just awful because it was an awful telecast. Right from the beginning, you heard Bob Costas and his co-host saying things like, the Central African Republic, as they marched in, that's in Central Africa. Well, thanks, Bob. what a huge new, you know, a just treasure trove of new information that you're telling us, you know. U.S., what was another one was U.S. Samoa, which is a U.S. protectorate. Well, I'm assuming that if it has U.S. in front of the name of the country, it probably is associated with the United States. I mean, it was absurd, and it just got worse. Anyways, I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thanks for the comment.
I can hear a future champion hurdler in the background with the call there. No, I hear much in what he's saying. As I say, part of me likes the narrativization into the personal because at least it is an attempt to acknowledge bringing in different kinds of viewers to the Olympic experience. But when it comes to the way NBC did it, again, I will tell one brief story that I hope people will forgive, but it's an emotional and important story about Australia. There was this sense to me throughout the telecast that U.S. citizens were being told, here's a place where people are mostly white, where they speak English, and they don't hate Yankees. Why don't you come and spend your tourist dollars here? I found that quite repugnant. And that particular view of Australia, which has been an extremely racist society itself, reached its apogee with a series of vignettes about JFK, when President Kennedy's PT-109 boat was hit by the enemy. As people will know, he, you know, very bravely swam to shore, made contact with so-called native peoples and Australian soldiers who were able to help him to survive and so on. This then became a way into talking about Australia's connection to East Timor. There was a major NBC feature one night about this. East Timor, which as people will recall, was a colony which became free briefly in the mid-1970s, and then Indonesia invaded. And people will remember that a couple of years ago, the Indonesian military was forced to leave, and now, thankfully, finally, the East Timorese are free, and they competed rather wonderfully at the Olympics. A very inspirational tale. Now, the way we were told this by NBC was that because the East Timorese, as is quite true, had fought the Japanese invasion during the Second World War and had helped to protect Australia, to defend it from invasion, statement that was made over and over again by NBC was, Australians don't forget their friends. Australians don't forget their friends. And this was why it was claimed last year when the Indonesians were having to leave East Timor, the Australian military went in with American and UN approval, as people will recall, to operate as a sort of protection agency in the nice sense of the term. This brutally forgets this notion of there being this wonderful direct link between the 1940s in the Pacific and the struggles of East Timorese and the Australians and Papua New Guineans and others against the Japanese and the other fascists, that brutally forgets that in the middle of that period, in 1975, when Indonesia invaded, President Gerald Ford and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger basically told the Australian government, you stick your noses out of it. The Indonesians are not Marxist-Leninist. There's a chance that Fretilin, the liberation movement of the East Timorese people, is on the left, and of course it was. that kind of nationalism we don't want. Stay out and let the Indonesians take it over. And the Australians lay down and did absolutely nothing. And for 20 years in the United Nations, struggle of East Timorese people completely silenced by the United States, Australia and their allies in ways that were really very egregious. So that NBC, I mean, the average American doesn't know that story, why should they? But that NBC could have given this vignette of Australians always remembering their friends and the salvation of Australia by many different island peoples and the United States, for that matter, in the Second World War, gets obliterated, or manages to obliterate this awful, awful dark moment in Australian history. It was appalling. And that summed up for me, I have to say, what NBC did.
Hmm. Let's take another caller here while we have time. Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm wondering, you're mentioning the broadcast networks, TV and radio and such. It occurs to me that prior to some few years and then after the Cold War ended, that a great deal of triumphalism has taken over, and the media has become full of American supremacy and the sorts of things that most people who don't look up swallow whole, and as if, and in educational institutions as well, as you just said about money talks and no tenure and part-time, and I've experienced some of that myself. I recently left a university, and that money seems to be the only driving force within all things in ordinary socialization and life itself. And in my estimation, this is leading us into the wall. And somehow, this has got to be addressed and something done about it. Or the next thing we know, that there'll be this tiny elite, which is pretty tiny now, which is going to become tinier, that will have all the power and the masses hovering around waiting either to stay alive by some means or just to die. And it seems to me that those questions, you know, should be on the minds of everyone, and that, and I guess my initial word then would stick that triumphalism seems to have taken over the media and its dissemination to the masses of the world. I'll hang up and listen to your comment. Thank you.
All right.
Well, money does talk. I think the call is right. I wouldn't pretend that I was immune to that. I like money too. So I don't want to suggest that there's a world that's pure that I occupy that everybody else should, you know, gather around in. I want to inject a little note of hope in this in terms of what I think is, not that I wish to sound like George W. or Al, being able to appeal to the brilliance of the average American and the American public's incredible good sense and so on. We've heard enough of that in the last 25 years. I'm sure it's true, but even so, there are some good stories out there, and one that I'd like to draw people's attention to very briefly. It's about the way in which there's been a comparatively organic movement emerging from undergraduate students right across the United States about sweatshop labor and apparel, attire, manufacture and assembly of college-endorsed clothing goods. The last 2 or 3 years, I'm sure you've probably addressed it in programs, David, or at least know about it yourself, we've seen 17, 18, 19-year-olds, so-called slackers, so-called post-Generation X slackers who allegedly are only interested in playing with Napster and getting good grades and, you know, putting their baseball caps on backwards or forwards or sideways, whatever it might be, who've said enough is enough. We don't want to proudly wear our school colors if we know that they have been put together by people maybe in Los Angeles, maybe in Korea, operating under what we regard as unacceptable labor conditions when huge profits are being made by companies, by universities, and so on. That level of idealism coming, as I said, from this generation that supposedly is written off as apolitical, not interested, not involved, has taught me a lot. And I think that they're doing this in a way that in some sense is reminiscent of the American war in Vietnam and the way in which many university students came to radicalism. But this isn't even about protecting yourself or your friends from the draft. This is something that is clearly unself-interested. Of course, there are oppositions to it. Of course, there are people who don't think it's a good idea. But it's a sign that not everybody in this society is completely caught up in a market-driven, sort of monetarized view of the world.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me for going back to this, but to the Olympics just for a second, but I'm interested in this issue of tape delay versus real-time coverage. That's another point of criticism, and again, so thinking back to the what CBC was doing. They in fact were doing short every hour. They were doing a short update before their national news in real time and making sort of snide asides to the fact that, yes, we're telling you right now what has just happened, and later tonight you can see it on NBC. And one can appreciate NBC's wanting to show stuff in prime time because they've spent so much money to get it. Do you think that's likely to change, or is tape delay coverage where they're sort of pretending that it's happening now, but of course everybody knows that it's not, and that if you were really interested, you could find out what the outcome of the event that you were watching already was.
Right.
That's not likely to change, is it?
Well, a lot of it comes from the fact that Australia is so many hours away. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a 16-hour time difference, I think, at this time of the year. It's never less than 14. Of course, Athens, where the next Olympics, Summer Olympics, will be held, won't have that problem. Salt Lake City, where the next Winter Games are being held, not quite the same, even less of a problem. Mm-hmm. But as I said, they did do this in Atlanta. I think what we'll see is that NBC, because it's probably lost a lot of money on this, if it claims it's breaking even, but who knows, it's going to try to influence the timing of events more and more. What we're going to see is an attempt to go back to live coverage, but not by putting programs, you know, highlights on outside prime time, rather trying to make sure that those key events in which Americans are participating that are potential ratings winners are available live or close to live during prime time hours. And that'll be the sort of change. Because with Athens, you're talking about somewhere that's 5 or 6 hours ahead. So if American running events or swimming events are held at 2 o'clock Athens time, that's not too bad for NBC. So I think that's where you'll see the change coming.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for talking with us once again. Our guest this morning, Toby Miller. He's a professor of cinema and cultural studies at New York University